Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
This is our interview with the host of the Left Anchor podcast on the state of the contemporary left. This is part one of a two-part discussion.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. Today I'm talking to Ryan and Alexi from Left Anchor.
Howdy.
Hello.
And we're talking, we'll be talking about the state of the left in general and left podcasting and all that. I didn't think I was going to ask you this, but what's the issue behind, how did your name become a thing? Like that of itself has always kind of like interested me.
Sure. And I don't know if this was the case for you, but we went a few rounds with a bunch of different ideas. My favorite one that I knew was never going to happen, but I liked it anyway, was Hot Takes with Habermas. But I just kind of knew that was going to be, kill your darlings kind of situation there. I don't know, Ryan, do you remember how it went?
I think if I'm not mistaken that after agonizing over it for like a month and a half, I came up with it as a sort of like, well, this'll do, kind of idea. But you know, it's since kind of grown on me a bit, because I always like nautical subjects, and so like I spent a lot of time sort of making the little anchor picture and finding,
it does tilt left if you pay attention, the anchor itself, right? Like it's
yeah, with my pathetic Photoshop skills, like tilting the little, PNG file and everything. But yeah, I think it's like it ended up being a pretty accurate representation of what we're trying to do, which is simultaneously lefty politics and such that's rooted in like, realistic sort of, seabeds and so forth.
Yeah. And for me, as often happens, the name gave rise to ideas about what it might mean. And so, as you might tell from Ryan and I listening to us, Ryan is more kind of concrete. He even just said realistic, grounded. He's more in the weeds of policy. He understands the granular history of events and thinkers and ideas really well. And I'm more big picture, abstract, theoretical, philosophical. And so there was a sense that complementarity could be good for the left to both bring together, right, theory and praxis. And in our little intro episode that probably nobody listens to because it's like a 3-minute little spiel, we do a little inversion where we say we want to ground the particular in the abstract or in the theoretical. And so I think there's kind of something for the left that's important to anchor what we're doing, because there's a tendency, right, to be very in the cycle of daily events and memes and fights and all that, and to try to anchor where we're directing our energy and time in some sound theory, if that makes sense.
So what would be your theoretical niche, so to speak? Most left groups and most left podcasts have them. Where do you see yourself? What like tradition or perspective do you seem to see yourself as embodying? And having listened to you guys for a couple, maybe about 2 months now, I would actually wouldn't know immediately where to place you normal spectrum of lefty opinion.
Yeah. What would you say if you had to, how would you answer it? If you were trying to be us, what would you think we would say?
The leftist end of the social Democrats, like the more left-wing end of the social Democrats. But even there, it's not totally a comfortable fit.
I would say, one of my foundational values is a kind of ecumenicalism. Like I'm really skeptical of like hardcore ideological schema, And I think that a lot of people get rooted into identifying as one school or another in ways that which can sort of make a hash of any kind of left-right distinction. I remember getting in a long argument with some, over social housing, over the idea of including, non-poor people in it. And it was just some guy who presented himself like, hammer and sickle, like ultra leftist type of argument. But like, the guy had backed himself into the basically Hillary Clinton and Eisenhower's views on public housing by trying to, you know, be more of thinking about the sort of spectral positioning rather than the actual realities. That said, I think I would sort of associate myself with the reformist socialist tradition, Edward Bernstein, Rudolf Hilferding. You know, I'm pretty favorable on like the kind of Nordic, like the trail that those folks have blazed forward. And that kind of fits in, you know, with the Polanyi view of socialism as being a, you know, subordinating the market to democratic society rather than the other way around. Beyond that, you know, implementation is really the most important thing, you know, and whether you can build a really competent bureaucracy and, you know, that could actually manage something that, you know, collectively controlled the means of production or whatever. But I'm certainly, you know, I look at the history of Leninism or Maoism or, you know, any of the more supposedly hardcore lefty schools of thought. And like, there's certainly something to, you know, Lenin's view of imperialism and so forth. And I think that, you know, the Russian Revolution is not as simple as some would have it, certainly on the right. But like, at the end of the day, that's not very promising results to point to, you know, in the Soviet Union and communist China and so forth. And so I think that the more kind of broadly egalitarian, reformist, and certainly democratic, you know, democratic is one of my like foundational values. I think that's probably more radical really in the long term than any kind of ideology about economics. And so that's kind of where I'm sitting.
Yeah. And I would say, kind of not just aligned with that, but connecting to your previous question about, you know, where we came up with Left Anchor and where it might fit perhaps in the millions of podcasts on the left. I think, you know, it's an open conversation, but one that's not just theoretical and about categorizing ourselves or others or finding ways to figure out if a certain thinker was better than a different thinker or to identify ourselves exclusively with certain schools of thought or thinkers. But because it is oriented so much to kind of politics in action today and to policy, I think we focus less on that. And like, if you think about it, right, let's say that I'm a democratic socialist and Ryan is more of a social democrat, for example. I think those lines get blurred now where we are in capitalism, right? Like, if you get, so because we're so capitalist and reactionary where we are today, it's going to look the same a lot of the time in practice, right? So like a lot of the disagreements are hypothetical or speculative, but like when push comes to shove and we've moved ourselves to say current day Scandinavia in the US, then maybe Ryan and I are going to start to diverge or something. Like maybe I'm going to push him to go further left, but like social democracy and democratic socialism, for example, look really similar right now in terms of perhaps what needs to be done. Like, we're not yet at the point where, like, and this does become interesting because, like, one thing that does separate us, I think, from liberals is there are many things that seem to us to reinforce capitalism now and to be clear ways of not progressing more to the left. But the things where we would start to really diverge from if you keep even that left-right spectrum as useful on the farther left, I just think that is less applicable to the actual practice of politics today. Maybe. That's one thought.
What are the issues that you would see right now as useful for sort of pushing you to where those divisions would be meaningful and not like theoretical identities? So, for example, you know, I kind of agree with you. And when it comes to a lot of these left distinctions in practice, there isn't that meaningful of a distinction. I mean, like, for example, to kind of echo Ryan for a second, and I would see myself as I would probably be to the left of both of you. Everybody says that, right?
Here's him now.
Yeah, right. But in a real sense, I see the point. One of the most fascinating things is like the quasi-Stalinist CPUSA almost always takes like the most milquetoast progressive in line with the center of the Democratic Party position for like a very outmoded notion of the popular front that only made sense in only maybe made sense in World War II. Like, but it's holding this for like historical reasons more than any other thing.
Right.
You know, they're not even answering the Moscow anymore. There's no reason for them to do this.
They just shifted their allegiance. Like, Moscow's not there anymore, so they went to, you know, Hillary Clinton. It's just sort of the same thing, really.
Yeah, so I definitely see that point. But what would you think we would need to do, but, you know, like, practically, policy-wise, for those distinctions to matter more?
Right. Well, it's a good question. Ryan, you might have a thought. I want to push Ryan a little bit on prison abolition, but again, it's the kind of thing where, let's say we disagree on how to get to a world without prisons, or to get rid of, you know, the vast mass incarceration system do we have. In a sense, it's almost tactical. So if I say that I want to demand, like, we abolish prison, what does that look like? What does that mean? And I think, like, in terms of utopian demanding, or in terms of the practice of politics, that's going to move us closer to maybe where Ryan wants us to end up with that or something. It's still going to be a difference of theory in the meantime, right? But we haven't had that talk, Ryan and I, yet so much. But I'm wondering, Ryan, what you think, like, where push comes to shove today on policy, where is that? So we're leaving the left liberal divide, but now I guess the kind of
left divide.
Right.
Yeah, that's an interesting sort of thought experiment, I suppose. So if he, you know, so like, what would the kind of like Ryan Cooper is dictator for a while program look like? You know, so it'd be, first of all, completed welfare state, you know, cradle to grave. Anybody who can't work for any reason gets, you know, is caught by the hand of the state. Students, elderly, disabled, children, unemployed, you know, all those generous benefits. Then you should stoop almost all of the capital, you know, all the wealth in the country into, at a minimum, some kind of sovereign wealth fund, social wealth fund, paying out like a per capita dividend. So now capital income is spread equally throughout society. And I think from there, you know, if that were the case, you know, if we went to like sort of, you know, where, imagine where Norway might be in like 50 years. Or where, you know, or I mean, if the U.S. did what Norway has done now, the fact of it being so much bigger, you know, would be a fairly substantial, you know, probably half the stock in the world in the social wealth fund and all that. I would guess that it would then come down to how the U.S. relates to the rest of the world. And in questions like, you know, do we get to the open borders utopia world by trying to sort of like slowly and gradually build in, you know, agreements between countries? So it's like you could say, okay, we're getting rid of the border. We're like sort of quasi getting rid of the border between Canada and the United States. And then we're getting rid of the one between Mexico and the United States and like just slowly building that out. Or should we go like a more revolutionary approach and just say like borders done? We're just gonna say it doesn't exist anymore, or like none of the controls are there anymore, and you can just like get rid of all the border checkpoints and everything. Or similarly, like in the case of the criminal justice system and police forces, do you have do you try to like slowly build down to a place in which there is no crime, more or less, you know, like, which is kind of the situation in the Nordic countries, where there's like, you know, I mean, there's a decent amount of sort of petty crime and property crime, but like, there's not that many murders, you know, like maybe it's a fifth or a tenth as many as there are in the United States. And the prisons are very luxurious, you know, and the maximum sentence is 20 years. Or do you just say, like, we're just letting everyone out of prison all at once? We're going to just try to get rid of just like get rid of prisons and get rid of police. There are no police, no prisons. That, you know, yeah, as Alexei said, I think that would be I think expose some pretty profound disagreements within the sort of like lefty coalition. But in terms of like what you're aiming at in realistic policy, you know, you definitely would be you know, in agreement, I would think, in like about 99% of cases.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I'm clearly to the left of Ryan in our vision and imagination of what I would want to be. But he, I think, is so grounded in what he thinks is possible and this like horizon that he sees that's just not something worth talking about. Maybe. I don't know if that's what you think, Ryan. But like, for example, if I could, I'd be like global communism. Like basically there's no right. Like get rid of global capitalism. The workers are the means of production. There's no wage slavery. Mark says you go fishing in the morning, you're a literary critic in the evening, you know, you make love in the afternoon, whatever. It's like the vision of a society that is not the resources, the power, the decisions are not at all structured and ordered through the capitalist system, but instead are really through the demos, through the people. And the question of demos, which we you know, with the Schmidt episode recently, is a tricky one, right? So if it's truly open borders, then the demos is the globe, then that presents its own problems of imagination. But just like hypothetically, as much as we can eradicate those sources of domination and free and liberate ourselves to collectively rule, right, whatever that might mean, in a way that that is more free and equal, whatever makes that happen is what I want, right? And so that's just a question that's more contingent to time and place and issue, right?
So let's take an immediate policy question. It's one I think about a lot. Medicare for all is something that, depending on who I hear articulate it, frankly, I either am horrified by or completely support, obviously. And the reason why I say that the horrified by is not that I'm horrified by the idea of Medicare for all, but it's that I've seen it already be co-opted, not by like, and I'm not talking about like of the Ryans of the world. I'm talking about of the Cory Bookers of the world.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. Medicare extra and shit.
Yeah. I mean, like it where like even sort of like, let's say the Bernsteinist, you know, evolutionary vision is not possible, even though they're using the same language as us. This is something I've thought a lot about with the kind of precarious nature, specifically of the DSA as an organization is going to have to deal with, because it's been really good at coming up with good rebranding of policy. Some of those policies that are actually, by the state of things right now, incredibly radical, but that I have heard people in, I don't know, the Vox sphere of the world be able to take that branding, that radical branding, and like insert fairly milquetoast policies back into the what was initially promoted. How do you guys think the left should deal with that? Because I think that's an immediate real issue.
I guess there's a policy bit and there's a rhetorical bit to this kind of discussion. Mm-hmm. So like, there's the co-option thing, as you say. Yeah, we got Medicare for extra. Or Medicare Extra, Medicare Plus for all, various buy-in programs. Amy Klobuchar says if you're over 50, you can buy in. That might be the worst one I've seen yet. Clearly, you know, Medicare is very solid branding. Everyone likes Medicare. And centrists are going to want to sort of latch on like barnacles to the Medicare for all idea and momentum and eviscerate all of the content of that, you know, the all the goodies, so that the profit streams of the, you know, big medical executives and insurance companies and so forth will be preserved. So rhetorically, I would say the important thing is to just basically expose the fraudulent proposals. Say like this, you know, this is fake bullshit that you're pushing right here. I don't think that's going to be too difficult. Like people are gonna be looking at this stuff all in depth. And if it's like Medicare Extra, you know, that's, I think even in normal person who doesn't know anything about this sort of discussion, it's going to set off some alarms.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like, well, we have the benefit, luckily, that rhetorically simplicity works better. And so having both truth and simplicity on our side means they have to lie in a more convoluted way. So people are going to be like, wait, why are you complicating this thing? And they'll have bullshit reasons for it that aren't true, right? Like, so like just rhetorically, we're in a better position because the simple answer happens to be the more egalitarian and the more liberatory one.
Yeah.
So. And I think to finish up the second part of it, the actual concrete discussion, if you are in a position, so say in 2021, Democrats have a House and the Senate, like by like a decent margin, you know, 4 or 5 votes. And suppose they do DC statehood and Puerto Rico statehood. So they got 4 more than them. Then it's going to be a political discussion sort of like within, you know, the party and the, you know, the activist community and so on about what's the best way forward. And here's a situation where I think the like sort of, you know, knee-jerk reformist Edward Bernstein approach is not good. What you should do is just try to get there all at once. You should rip the Band-Aid off. You know, we're talking about $1 trillion a year in pure fucking waste and fraud. You know, so many hospitals and so many clinics and so many doctors and insurance companies are frankly just like involved in criminal activity. They are like defrauding the people in their most vulnerable moments when they are sick and injured and near death. And so the way to do it, the way to pass the policy and preserve the political coalition that supports the policy is to make something that's really good for the rest of the whole population, like best healthcare system in the entire world, and concentrates all the pain on a small number of wealthy people. And, you know, and like you could have some sort of, if you did it really hard, it would end up being a big austerity bill, right? Because you'd be basically cutting national spending by like $800 billion or $1 trillion. And so you'd have to have like a giant stimulus coupled to that to make sure the economy doesn't collapse into recession. But at any rate, so you do something like that and you basically, you just run the opposition over and you hope that the policy is good enough to that people will be grateful. The rest of the population, the like 97% of people who aren't involved in this business or 90%, whatever it is, will continue to, they will be pleased. I think they would be actually ecstatic to see that this, you know, it's like you wouldn't even have to pay any more taxes at all. We've already got enough if you were aggressive enough, or more realistically, it would only be a small. Whether you could do that, I have no fucking idea. But that's what I would, that's the argument. If I were president or something, I that's the argument I would make, you know, to push for that or push as close as to that as you could get.
So when you're trying to ground these policies into a more theoretical framework, of course, people tend to go to Marx and Engels, you know, whatever. And I don't say whatever because that's not important. It's just, you know, leftists tend to do that.
Yeah.
But who else do you find yourself going to a lot?
You know, it's interesting you say that. This is not planned, but just in terms of who we have discussed a lot. Ryan, who would you say? I mean, whether or not we studied their texts explicitly, Machiavelli comes up a lot, right? Yeah. Rousseau, I mean, the social contract theorists come up a lot. Kant comes up a lot, but usually to critique. Basically, from Plato and Aristotle, right, through the social contract, through Machiavelli, Hobbes, Machiavelli and the social contract theorists to Kant, that tends to be kind of a basis for trying to illuminate where certain people ideologically are coming from in different policy debates. What do you think, Ryan?
I mean, as part of the podcast, I read Hobbes for the first time. And that's like, I think the best, the Leviathan, I think, is the best piece of political theory is ever written. And I mean, it's not like, not that I agree with him on everything, but like he anticipates everything. And he's so clear and so realistic in his thinking that it was just like kind of transformative. Polanyi, another big influence. Mikhail Kalichki, I'm probably butchering that pronunciation. Gramsci. Gramsci is a very important, like in his stuff about ideology, I think that had a pretty big influence on my thinking.
And we try to bounce around and draw the parallels between, say, a Machiavelli and a Hobbes. And then, right, like a Foucault, and try to kind of, you know, for an audience that I think is less familiar with a lot of these texts or just in a cursory way, just to bring in more thinkers and try to link up the different genealogies of thought. Sorry, Ryan, I interrupted you. This is my want.
Oh, no, yeah, no worries. Oh, I just saw some more contemporary folks. Keynes is good. Joan Robinson. And some contemporaries, you know, Piketty is very good. J.W. Mason's is kind of a actual guy I know. Marshall Steinbaum, Gabriel Zucman. There are a number of sort of like up and coming heterodox folks that I think have a lot of insightful stuff that I try to read what they're putting out.
Yeah, I guess it depends if we're using a thinker to investigative policy. Often it's the opposite. Often we're just diving into some theory or political philosophy just to read it together and talk about it. And then that sometimes gets coupled with something topical that might relate to it or not. But often it does, actually. Yeah, what did you find, Derek, in listening to a few episodes? What did you...
I was interested in how much you go back to classical, like what I would call revolutionary bourgeois text.
Right, right.
But just the classical Enlightenment tradition comes up a lot, and the different factions of it. It's one of those things that I always find frustrating about Americans, even though I am one, is that there's this tendency to talk about like classical liberals as if that was all ceded to libertarianism, and I'm like, no, like.
Right.
Most of socialism, most of progressive liberalism, most of conservatism all comes out of the classical, the kind of revolutionary classical liberal critique. Although I do wonder about now, because we live in a moment where the right is actually beginning to abandon its like classical liberal roots in a way in America. Weirdly, one of the things about the Trump era, even though it's its own American kind of gauche way, right, is the right does act a lot more like a European right would than an American right traditionally has. And that's been interesting to see that shift in realignment. I don't know if that's – I mean, ultimately it's bad in the immediate. I don't know how to feel about it in the long term. The one thing it has seemed to do is make the kind of Democratic center a lot more precarious. And the Republican center are a lot more precarious as well.
Certainly.
Have you noticed that either one of you, or how do you feel about this idea that like while we're seeing kind of a renaissance in left-wing thought in America, it does seem to be at the behest of the fact that we're living in a very right-wing moment and that the kind of center couldn't say anything to it or hadn't seeming to be able to say much.
Right, which is what Jonathan Chait explicitly wrote about once. He's like, I'm a liberal true and true, but the left seems useful to me right now. Remember that, Ryan?
Yeah, I do. How could I forget?
When Jonathan Chait sees the light, that's a dark moment.
Boy, yeah. Topsy-turvy world we're in.
No, I think that's interesting. So, and I'm not sure if the tenor of the question is about how we should feel about this moment and going forward, or how we think about politics, given the state of the form of reactionary politics that's kind of in ascendance. I take it then, Derek, what do you think of Corey Robbins' kind of take on Trump in line with his kind of
reactionary mind stuff?
I wrote many years ago. I wrote a review of the reactionary mind, which I was mostly positive about. Although I think I did go into some specific things he left out. And then some things that he kind of saw as reactionary that I didn't. But I think he's kind of right. It's hard. It's the thing about Trump that has been hard to deal with is other than like a couple of symbolic things like the wall and like his personal presentation, he's actually remarkably nebulous. Like he had policy papers up in his presidential campaign. If you look at how he actually runs things, none of them have mattered. So that, it's very hard to say what Trumpism actually is. Other than like kind of like alt light, the diet, the Bud Light of reactionary nationalism, but like
the uglier, more shallow narcissistic version. Yeah, I like it.
But I am constantly trying to figure out, we all know that the working class wasn't part of how Trump came into power. That's not to say the working class in America doesn't have its problems, but it just didn't vote. Like that didn't vote heavily in any election, maybe except in Wisconsin, in which it kind of did matter. But the idea of the same people who could vote for Obama twice voting for Trump is something that I know statistically it had to happen, but I don't understand.
Yeah. I think there are about 8 million people who are double Obama Trump voters. The best explanation of that I can come up with in my own head is a possibly apocryphal story that I remember from 2008 when there was a canvasser who was calling a white working class like household, downscale white voters in, I believe, Pennsylvania. I could be wrong about that, but the canvasser is like talking to someone's wife and it's like going on, blah, 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 blah. you know, trying to talk about Obama, and her husband is just sort of annoyed, grabs the phone, says, "We're voting for the N-word," and slams back down on the hook. And I think, you know, it's like you have, to the extent that that working class people do vote at all, there is a strain of you know, racist reactionary belief there, but it is counterbalanced in potentiality by a kind of class interest and class ideology, some lingering shreds of unionism. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that came out for me from actually watching some Trump rallies on, you know, videos, instead of just reading about him in the newspaper — I think either of those can be kind of misleading in their own way — but you watch the rallies, most of the time, at least during the campaign, when he's in those Rust Belt states, he's talking about how all these countries are screwing us with these slanted trade deals. Under Trump, everyone's going to get a high-paying manufacturing job, you know, obvious, like, patriarchal overtones there. Like the good old days of you know, 1950s, high wages and secure economic, like, situation is coming back. Very vague, but, like, the messaging was compelling, you know. And he sounded like, as I forget who said it, he sounded like reactionary FDR. You know, it's like, we're going to stick it to China. We're going to stick it to Mexico. And we're going to, you know, create an America where we cater to the needs of the people again.
So an FDR stumper in the South in the 40s.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there were people like that, just, you know, really racist guys who were also really anti, you know, capitalist, like, pro working class type of people.
Huey Long.
Yeah. So Huey Long was, for his time, I think, not too racist.
No, actually, he wasn't that racist, no matter where it came out of. Yeah.
These things are complex, and identities are complex. And, you know, because racism is so terrible, we forget that it might not be the dominating influence or motivation all the time for people who even kind of internalize racism, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, it might not be a virulent form of racism. It might be the kind of racism that says, oh, he seems like a good black guy, right? Like, I like this black guy, right? You know, the kind of, yeah, racism that is like, oh, Obama's my kind of black guy, right? Like, something like that. He's the change candidate, and I hate above all, right, the establishment. And, oh yeah, he's patriotic. He's talking about, there's not a red America, there's not a, you know, blue America, there's the United States of America. He's not the angry black man, right? And he kind of shits all over Jeremiah Wright. So maybe he's one of us, right? And it's really, and these people, probably many of them, think that they're not racist. And they hate people that call them racist. And the Black Lives Matter, and those are the ones that are politically correct, and they're making me feel like I'm a bad person. Like, you know, I'm one of the despicable ones. And so maybe there's some weird psychology, and it's complex at the end of the day, where a whole contingent of groups that vote for Trump don't think of themselves as racist at all, really, even though they are. And really, above all, what they care about is making America great again. Damn the establishment. And it just so happens, right, that white Christian nationalism and white supremacy maps over with that pretty well.
I think maybe one of the sort of perverse effects of the Clinton campaign was associating, you know, the anti-racism with this sort of, like, hectoring HR manager affect that is like explicitly capitalist in terms of its framing and context. I mean, not really for the platform, but in terms of who Hillary Clinton really did represent. And I mean, you know, you go back and look at Obama's 2012 ads, they hit Romney hard on class stuff. It was these old white guys who had been run out of their jobs by Mitt Romney's vulture capitalist firms. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we used to make good steel here, and they came in and they threw everyone out. We lost our health insurance. And it was so, I mean, if you remember, Cory Booker was really uncomfortable with this. Like, don't stop insulting Bain Capital. You know, these people donate money to my campaign.
Yeah, and there was a big divide with Romney and Obama over GM, right, in Michigan.
Yeah.
He said they should, this was, I think, the first thing that Andrew Kaczynski ever dug up, that 2009 op-ed where Romney said, let Detroit go bankrupt. And, you know, Obama didn't have the strongest class politics, but he did rescue the auto industry.
Maybe Obama and fooled not only leftists, but he fooled potential Trump voters into thinking he was for their class.
He was in the context of that election, because Romney would have just been like, fuck you. I'm voting the Wall Street line 100% of the time. At least Obama, you know, did rescue Wall Street, even if he did cause 9 million foreclosures. But then in 2016, you have a different choice. You have a sort of like the combination of a quasi-economic populist and also a racist, quasi-race, you know, kind of chauvinist who's like sticking it to the libs. And I think that's a kind of dangerous combination. He's actually governed, but like, I think that could really play very, very well. You know, you read Tucker Carlson's new book, which is all economic populism and like white supremacist rhetoric, basically.
And don't forget that had Hillary Clinton won, 4 out of the last 5 presidents would have had the last name Clinton or Bush, right? So that's plutocracy, aristocracy, right? So in an election where that's the case, you have a fucking populist. You know, I mean, of course, that's an election where you're going to risk losing to a populist.
And Hillary Clinton herself being an awful politician, just really bad at campaigning, very unattractive personality. You know, it's like Obama's basic political ideology stripped of most of its like class content and without any kind of charisma to sell it. It just faceplanted horribly.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.